Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, the fluoridated, the allegedly Fukushima irradiated, but of course we don't know because we stopped testing the seawater for radiation like last year sometime, because obviously it's just not a threat, and we never tested any of our imports or anything like that either, because obviously it's just not worth the worry. I mean, look, if you're going to be contaminated with nuclear radiation, it's best if you not know about it, because that way you can keep continuing to buy the contaminated products and support the economy. Just like a lot of the rest of the population who now are supporting the economy through their part-time jobs and incandescent light bulb. And my very special guests are Sophia Smallstorm and Ole Damegaard. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you so much.
I'm unfamiliar with Sophia, so would you be able to give us a little bit of an intro about yourself, who you are, what it is you do?
I'm a curious person, and I try to learn more about things that I'm curious about. And that's it, and that's all.
Can I jump in here? Sophia Smallstorm is an incredible researcher in this Sandy Hook and other major false flag and so on. I've got great respect for her work.
Yes, you know, thank you. That's very nice of you. So many people think, I had someone tell me yesterday that he thought I was a nanobiologist, and I am not. I am not a PhD in any way. I have managed to get my brain to chew down on some science, and I think sometimes the less we know in terms of expertise, technical expertise, the more easy it is to make some connections that the people who are buried in their tiny little mouse hole of research will never see, you know?
Kind of like doing a PhD on the small toe of a camel or something of that nature. It just has no practical significance, and it doesn't really have any connections or satisfaction for any given researcher. And in fact, maybe if I can qualify something you've said there, in some cases I've found the less educated somebody is, the less barriers come up to their research. Because I found that education is something that just sort of, it's like a intellectual or cognitive immune system where it simply attaches antibodies to new ideas, radical ideas and things of that nature, and destroys them and expels them from the brain.
Yeah, possibly. I have fallen into a whole new line of awareness just as of this morning. And I was turned on to a woman, Samantha Khoury, yesterday, and I did watch her video. It's a documentary made about her called I Talk to Animals. And this woman is one of those animal whisperers. She actually can figure out what the animal is annoyed about or suffering from, and she can talk to it and tell it, okay, we're going to fix this situation in your life where you have to stop doing this, that, or the other thing. And she talks to animals and receives information from them in by way of pictures. You see, we don't do that, humans. We think in words and thoughts, which are very amorphous, and yet experience is all about pictures. And that set off this giant light bulb in my head. So, Ole, I think you said you saw her in person?
Yeah, I did in Stockholm. I've been admiring her for many, many years. As far as in my world, she was the first animal whisperer I ever came across, and she's extremely detailed in the information given. An absolute beautiful woman who had a very, very hard childhood, where the only one that she could communicate and get along with were it was her dog. And she thought that it was natural to communicate with animals. She had no idea that no one else was doing it. And she, just like you say, she does it with pictures. She receives images and she sends images, and that's the way she gets it. But she gets extremely detailed information. I know once, for instance, she was called home to a home where they had three dogs and they were barking all the time very, very viciously. And Samantha went in there and stayed with the dogs and asked them, so, hey guys, what's going on here? You know, this is not very popular, you barking all the time. And these dogs said, but we're really, really upset with our owner. And so she said, so what's going on? No, he's having an affair. He's bringing this other woman into our home here and behind the back of his wife, and that's not on. So Samantha was like, oh my God. How am I going to tell the owner about this? But she did. She told the woman that owned the dogs that, well, according to your dogs, your husband is having an affair and he's bringing her home here.
The dogs told her that the woman's husband was acting like a dog.
There you go. But anyway, the woman got extremely upset, threw Samantha out, but then called her about a week later saying that she confronted her husband and he first denied, but then he admitted it all. And after he got rid of this woman, he ended the affair, they got back together and the dogs were fine.
So I didn't bring this up because of, poignant little stories. Really, I brought it up because everybody I know who's awake complains bitterly about the condition of the earth today, and politics and chemtrails and vaccines and this, that, and the other. But I think we can't do this just in thoughts and words. We have to somehow wake up in us the ability to use the spectrum of our powers, and I'm looking at something, you know, the visible spectrum is light, and that's how we see what happens around us. And if we can retain those experiences in the form of memories, they're like photographs taken from the visible spectrum. We have to start doing this. We have to start seeing the corrections that we want, not just complaining about them. And I know people have said this before, but I never really understood it till today. So you have to watch that video, I Talk to Animals.
Well, I wanted to actually make a point here actually kind of correct you in your first statement about how we only really think in words and ideas and things of that nature. Absolutely not true. There's a guy called Sir Ken Robinson who used to be on the board of the Royal Ballet, and he did a really great speech in front of the TED conference in Los Angeles one time. And he said that basically what happens is education trains you out of all of your other modes of thinking, because we think in every single way that we can interact. We think in smell, we think in music, we think in movement, we think kinesthetically. And what the education system is predicated on is that all of those forms of creativity don't have any value, and they strip mine people's minds for a particular commodity. That thinking and ideas and that word part that you're talking about.
Well, I think what I meant when I was saying that was we are left with these. I mean, when I talk, I literally see a typewriter in my head and it's typing every word out. This is why it kind of drives me nuts to hear foreign languages, because I don't know how to spell them and I can't type it in my head. So I don't know how I ended up with that mechanism, but I am not thinking and using all the modalities that you just talked about. And I don't think a lot of people are.
Well, yeah, they've been squandered, more or less.
Yeah.
I mean, if you were born a natural runner or something like that, and you were told constantly throughout your entire life to sit down, stop moving, don't move too fast or anything like that, how good of a runner are you going to develop into?
That's right. So, you know, I've talked to Ole before on Skype about the nature of the world today, and I can hear in him the distress. And then I listened to a show that a YouTube of him addressing the public in Denmark in front of the Bilderberg conference, and he was all inspired. And I thought, okay, so these are two sides of the same person, and what lies in between, and how can all of us, you know, really like activate the inspired part of ourselves such that it starts playing out in real life?
Well, it's kind of like in my opinion, the way to get that going is sort of like by taking action. Most of the time we have thoughts that occur to us and they're like, wow, that'd be great, that's a good idea, or maybe I should do that. But within 5 seconds, your brain will either pull the handbrake or it'll activate, and most people choose to pull the handbrake and never fulfill their dreams. And so they spend the vast majority of their life denying who it is they are and denying what inspires them and spending their life doing something else.
Okay, but those of us who haven't denied that, I mean, who are, you know, trying to do something in our own way, I think we can still do more. And that's what I'm going to try to figure out for myself. Not just YouTube lectures and audio interviews and a few posts on my website and my newsletters. There's another modality yet, and many more after that. And that's where I want to go.
Specifically?
Well, after I watch this video, I'm like on fire about this talking to animals and seeing pictures of the future, going into the animal's being or connecting with it and seeing pictures that they're giving you of the situation that they don't like. I mean, if she can do it, she says everybody can do it. I think I have to start thinking in pictures more. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, and on top of that, the communication with other creatures and things of that nature, we're talking about a balance between, I think, a lot of what humans are brought up to believe and a lot of what's actually real, but it's kind of like just below the surface and we're not kind of like aware of our own abilities to a large degree. Is that what you're talking about?
That, and I, at the same time, right now I'm in the middle of an interview with somebody on Red Ice, let's see what his name is, Anthony Peake, P-E-A-K-E, he's from Britain.
I've had him on the show a couple of times, he's great.
Yeah, he's been talking about this writer, Philip K. Dick, and I'm telling you, Philip Dick was all about orthogonal time, which isn't linear time, and I don't understand that very well, but that's where we have to go. I said in my Sandy Hook talk, it was titled, Unraveling Sandy Hook in 2, 3, 4, and 5 dimensions. And I didn't really go into the 6th dimension, which is where everything is. All possibilities for all things are in that dimension. I did explain that we have the ability to pull from all possibilities those that really happen in our linear 3D lives. So this orthogonal time is basically the 6th dimension. And I think that the perpetrators are operating out of another dimension, and they're doing things to us, and we're sitting here trapped in this 3rd dimension, and all we can really do is react. We're going, ooh, ow, stop it, don't do that. Well, how can we get away from this? And we're not going anywhere.
Well, I find that there's two problems here, because on the one hand, you've got people who deny the existence of anything other than three-dimensional. They deny any kind of psychic abilities. They deny any kind of spiritual abilities or what have you. And they say, no, this is it. This is all there is. And then there's another group of people, which in my opinion are even worse, who deny the 3D reality is actually having any relevance and only say the fifth dimension and stuff that they can't see or can't interact with right in front of this thing that they can't even actually show people exists is the only thing that matters. And in so doing, they lose touch with the reality that we all share.
You mean like the New Agey types?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the slippery slope, because I found if you need to have an effect on the world around you in order to feel justified in your existence, and I think any reasonable person actually needs that to a degree. We need interaction with other people. We need to be taught things. We need to be accepted. Really? And I think this is why high school's so damaging to everybody, because you don't learn anything and you never get accepted.
Lloyd, do you have anything to say?
I tell you, Sophia, you talked about the difference being inspired and not being inspired. And at the moment, I've taken a break. I've gone back to Sweden for a few weeks and just tried to regroup, relax, breathe, get back in balance, because I feel when I'm not in touch with whatever it is that inspires me, a higher power, whatever you want to call it, if I'm not in touch with that, then I don't do a lot of good. I just go around in circles, so I need to regroup. So at the moment, I don't speak so much. I prefer to gather my strengths instead.
Now, I'm also a bit confused because I have not seen your Sandy Hook presentation, Sophia. Would you be able to actually give us a little bit of a recap of what you actually delve into that in that presentation?
Well, I really structure it around the second dimension and the third dimension. The second dimension is, you know, the printed world and the screens that we see all the time. And the techniques that certain people have today with information are so good, they're so developed, that they can fictionalize anything in the 2D world. And that's what happens with these events. They are largely fictional. They are taken to the screen, and the public is allowed to run with them. Now, I do explore the concept that Sandy Hook was a large-scale drill called an integrated capstone event. And if you picture the pyramid, even on the dollar bill or any pyramid, the very top peak of that is called the capstone. And on the dollar bill, that's where that eye is, the all-seeing eye. So in these drills, which are comprised of many different teams, they're Homeland Security drills. The all-seeing eye, the people who know everything and have organized the drill, are at the top of the pyramid. And then all the resources, you can read about these drills, capstone events, on, you know, FEMA's website. But all of the teams, like the hospitals and the first responders and the police and the highway patrol and media, they're all resources involved in the drill. And again, each of those is a pyramid. And at the very top level of those teams are people who know what's really going on. And everybody else in the resource team knows less and less and less down the hierarchy. So in these drills, you've got a very small number of people who have organized and are managing the drill. And everybody else is instructed. The nature of the drill is to act on your training and use your best judgment. So this is where they give an aspect of the drill to the media to run with. And for instance, that aspect would be, okay, so we had a shooting and there was a 20-year-old who used to go to this elementary school, and he came back and he knocked off a bunch of kids and teachers and he broke into the school somehow. So then the media goes running with that. And the thing is, the exercise doesn't end that day. The whole purpose of it is a surveillance of society in this context. And it's a prolonged experiment, and it has the ability to seed change, radical change within the society. So the stories continue that the media puts out, and many of these stories do not comport with 3D reality. For instance, the original story itself, that Adam Lanza was, you know, autistic, he had Asperger's, he was very thin. In the final police report, he's said to be 6 feet tall and 112 pounds, and he's got all this weaponry strapped to him, which would be very difficult to discharge and manage with that kind of emaciated frame. So the 2D stories don't even fit the 3D reality, but that doesn't bother most of the public. So all of this is observation that's going on of us. And there are some of us who say, wait, you can't have that. The kid like that could never shoot that many people in that span of time, etc., etc. So all this is being observed.
It seems so much like many mass shootings where there are conflicts within the official stories. What this specifically reminded me of was the Port Arthur massacre in Australia, where, again, a person who was allegedly mentally disabled managed to kill, like, 20 people or something like that, and only fire like maybe around 20 shots, and be reported to be pirouetting in between shots and kills and things of that nature. Like, I was like looking at the real story and what the official story was, and I was like, professional assassin probably committed this, and the official story is just some patsy.
Well, today, given that time has passed and the nature of the public is even more...
dumbed down?
Out of it, yeah, unconscious and unconcerned. That's another quality that has developed in the masses. The lack of interest in self-preservation. The reliance on a societal order that will just, you know, fill in the blanks for you. Take care of whatever. You know, don't make your dinner. Go and stop off at Taco Bell and buy something wrapped in a piece of waxy paper that you don't even know the contents of. That's how people are. They have really shoved off the need or interest or desire to control their own lives. And all of this is part of the forming of the post-human world. So you want maybe that I should explain that. We are in this transition called transhumanism. We're moving from Homo sapien to Homo something else. And there is a popular name for it out there. Maybe it's just a working name. It's called Homo evolutus. And we are now already holding in our physical bodies, our cells, what's called CDB, cross-domain bacteria. We are not eukaryotic. And here I would have to go into biology a little bit, but we have elements from the other life kingdoms in our subcellular structures. So we are moving already from Homo sapien toward Homo evolutus or Homo something else. And that's the beauty of what they've managed to create, is we are the living laboratories. We are the modes and means of the change, and we don't even know it.
It seems to me that the human race is kind of like, on the one hand, we've been told that we've got all this potential and everything. On the other hand, we forcibly have all that potential squandered. And then furthermore, on top of that, because we don't know what it is to be human anymore, it makes it so much easier to accept things like upgrades, you know, implants, microchips.
Hybrids. We've grown used to hybrids. We eat hybridized fruit. We have hybridized pets. You know,
we drive hybrid cars.
Exactly. So the hybrid is the model that we are ourselves becoming. The hybrid is it. That's how they're doing everything, hybridization. The influx of immigrants into Northern European countries and America also from South America. This is all hybridization.
It's dilution, and what seems to be interesting is that there's a resistance and an awareness of this transhumanist agenda, and it's quite sad because the apathy and the lack of curiousness, which you so eloquently pointed out, prevents people from even listening to this type of dialogue and even figuring out what is killing them. You know, a lion could be chewing on somebody's ankle, you know, in a figurative sense of the word, and you say, "Bro, it's a lion on your ankle. It's going to eventually eat all of you." And you're like, no. I'll just have myself another beer, and it'll be all right.
Well, you know, there was a story by Herman Melville, the American writer, 1853, called Bartleby the Scrivener. Are you familiar with it?
No, I'm sorry.
It's subtitled A Story of Wall Street. And I just came across it again, and I hadn't reread the whole thing, but I remember very clearly when I first read it, which I think was in college. And Bartleby was this scribe, because at that time they didn't have photocopy machines, they didn't have typewriters, and so if you wanted a copy of something, you had to either sit down and write it all out yourself, or you had to hire someone. So he was what they called a scribe or scrivener. And he worked for this lawyer on Wall Street back in, you know, the 1850s. Picture it. And at the end of the day, his boss said, "Well, Bartleby, we're closing up, you know, it's time to stop, and we have to all go home." And Bartleby said, "I prefer not to." And he never went home, he never stopped writing, and every single question they ever asked him, he answered, "I prefer not to. I prefer not to." He was like a broken record, that was the only thing he said. Now, that's what I see happening in the public today. They just prefer not to do what you're trying to put in front of them, even if what it is trying to wake them up to the fact that there's a lion on their foot. "Don't you want to know about this? Don't you want to do something about it?" "I prefer not to." And that equates to the path of least resistance taken by electricity also, curiously.
Well, we're not electricity and we're not water, although we're full of water and we're full of electricity. However, we've got a choice about whether or not we act like it. Isn't that interesting? Human potential, ladies and gentlemen, there's a huge, huge amount of it. And by all means, continue to be apathetic and continue to not care about anything, and you'll never achieve it. Thank you very much for listening. My very special guests have been Ole Damegaard from lightonconspiracies.com. Is that exactly the right website?
It is, and I'm very quiet today, so I apologize for doing a radio show.
It's in the middle of the night, bro. What do you expect?
It is indeed.
He needs to get some nap time. And Sophia Smallstorm as well, do you have a website, or perhaps give people the name of a video or anything like that about your Sandy Hook presentation? Sophia, are you there? Okay.
I sent you the link to her talk about Sandy Hook. It's here in the chat.
All right. I've got that one there. So, Sophia Smallstorm Unraveling Sandy Hook on YouTube is the one to look out for there, ladies and gentlemen. You've been listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we'll be right back. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulous, the fluoridated, the allegedly irradiated, because we don't know how much, because we stopped testing the seawater some time ago, at government orders. You know, they thought, well, all these contaminated radioactive products from Fukushima coming in that we don't test on the docks anyway, let's stop testing the seawater too. I mean, what's the worst that could happen, you know? And we're also the least corrupt country in the world, according to Transparency International, because they sent us out these big questionnaires. In fact, they send them to every country, and they ask you to voluntarily submit. They go, "Hey, bro, are you guys corrupt? Have you got any corruption going on in your country? And New Zealand goes, nah, bro, we're not. And we send the form back blank. And so that's why we're number one, least corrupt in the world. Because those in this country who are charged with exposing and punishing the corrupt are in fact corrupt. Hence, they don't report any or punish any. Thank you. My very special guest today, who's an expert in corruption of so many fields, kind of like Monsanto, they corrupt fields, you know, that's the joke I was going for there. His name's G. Edward Griffin, and he is the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island, and a number of other great books, which can basically enlighten you about a fair amount of subject matters, including health as well. Ed, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Good to be on your show again.
It's been some time, has it not?
Yes, it has.
What have you been up to recently?
Well, I've been up to rating the corruption levels of various countries, and I loved your introduction there.
How ironic.
No, what have I been up to? Okay, well, that's a good question. I've been doing just a lot of make work, trying to keep my head above water, but I try and keep my mental eye, at least, on some important issues. I'm still working on my next book. I hope we get it done, which tentatively is entitled The Future is Calling, and it's about the solutions to all of the problems we have, and your listeners know those very well. So I'm still working on that. We're advancing Freedom Force as rapidly as we can. That takes a lot of time. We're producing some interesting documentaries. That's taking some time. And just having a very good, a good life here, fighting evil and saving the world.
Yeah, it's always fun. I don't know. Is the reason for doing this because it's oh so fun, or because basically to do anything else, just you can't?
Right. Right, you are. Well, yeah, that's the problem with some of us. I mean, we get these grandiose ideas, these silly ideas that we can actually change the world in some small way if we can get others to join with us. And so we just keep chasing the dot, and one of these days we'll catch it.
Well, I think it's like, at the end of the day, what's the alternative to doing something to try and save the world? Doing nothing to try and save the world? I don't see much of a choice in that equation.
Yeah, well, that's the trouble with people like you and me. We have this great optimism that it's first of all it's worth trying to save, and secondly, we even greater optimism to think that well, maybe if we really do it right and work really hard, we can actually help to accomplish it, and we just keep chasing that idea. And I have to say that I think that is a lot better than. Then sitting in a cardboard box, facing the backside and eating a can of worms, saying, oh, yeah, life is terrible, life is bad, and I'm a total cynic, and nothing's ever going to change, nothing you can do to, change the world, it's all going downhill, and, all of that stuff. That's so depressing. I went through a little bit of that years and years ago, and I realized that it wasn't good for me, and it certainly wasn't good for society, it wasn't good for the world, because... Well, as I said, some of us just have this crazy idea that it is worth changing and that we can make a difference. So we're stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it's funny you should mention that because this last week, that's exactly what I've been feeling. I've been feeling stuck. It's like, damn, I'm stuck in a position where I'm a freedom fighter that's respected by my countrymen for exposing scumbaggery and helping humanity and everything that's good and right in this country. Damn it! Freaking career it's like career suicide, and and the other thing I've been doing just recently on Facebook is arguing with we've got an election going on here in New Zealand right now, and I'm arguing with people who refuse to vote and are encouraging others to not vote. And I say, well, if you don't want to vote, that's fine and dandy, but it's not going to accomplish anything. Not voting doesn't accomplish anything, just like not doing anything doesn't accomplish anything. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So my opinion was like, okay, there's 1,000 days in between elections in New Zealand, roughly. So my way of compensating for the fact that I'm voting for a party that exposes corruption and doesn't want to sell the country out to foreigners and does get elected previously, in order to compensate for supporting the system in that way, I spend those 3,000 plus days in between elections exposing scumbaggery and helping people who the media ignore to get their voices out. And I think that actually makes me, you know, at the very least on an even keel, doing the right thing by humanity, even if I'm voting in a fault in a system that's basically rigged.
Well, yeah, I agree with that, Vinny. And, you know, I think it's based on the assumption, this idea that you're talking about, that, you know, voting doesn't count, even though you and I might agree that it doesn't have any immediate consequences. It's based on the assumption that voting could count under some circumstances. It's based on the assumption that voting is important. And I'm not saying it's not, but what that assumption leads to is that voting is all you have to do. In other words, you have to, you either vote or you don't vote, and that's the end of your options, you know. You're not going to take make a major play in educating people or changing their minds or enlightening them. You're just going to wait around until finally somebody selects a candidate for you, and then you go out and say, well, let's see, which one of these scumbums do I want to vote for? Well, I don't like either one of them, so I won't vote, and I won't do anything else for the rest of the year either. I won't take a role or play a role in choosing candidates for the next round. I won't do any of that because that doesn't count. That's too much effort anyway. You know, so, yeah, it's too much focus on the voting part, as though that's all there is to it. And as you and I know, that's we think it's important, but it's way down the line of important things. Other things are even far more important because they lead to the climate and the influence within these power centers in society, including the political parties, that determine who you're going to have a chance to vote for.
Well, the other element that I wanted to get on here is, if there is somebody legitimate that you're voting for, if you disbelieve the political system in general, and then you don't vote for somebody who's legitimate, and then they've got nothing to say about it, right? Like, let's take, for example, Penny Bright, who's a corruption watchdog, who campaigned for the mayor of Auckland, our largest city, was, I'm going to stop corporate corruption, I'm going to stop all of these private contractors taking over the city council. And she was the fourth most highly voted candidate, right? With zero budget, okay? And mm-hmm. I thought to myself, what if those thousands upon thousands of people that voted for her were representative of a whole bunch of other people who are incredibly disillusioned with the system that is so corrupt and that would actually vote for her legitimately? And then, of course, most of those people would just see that she wouldn't win, and so therefore never vote for her, okay? So she may have been the third or the second most highest polling candidate if people weren't so disillusioned with the system in the first place. It's kind of like a catch net. You want to prevent corruption by not voting, but as a result, corruption gets in by default.
Yes, so good. Yeah, it's a good analogy, I think, Ben. So, yeah. So there you have it. So let's go forth and communicate. I guess that's our goal, isn't it?
Well, yeah, as the media people. Speaking of which, are there any news stories in the United States of significance that you've been looking into recently, or is it predominantly your projects with Freedom Force documentaries, etc., that you're focused on now?
Well, Ben, you know, we produce a weekly news report called Unfiltered News. And so we're elbows deep in daily news. It's not just here in the States. It's world news, but naturally there's a primary focus here. We have subscribers all around the world, but probably 85% of them are U.S.-based. So, yeah, we see the daily news, and most of it's bad. You know, there are riots going on in some parts of the country right now because some black kid was shot by a white police officer. And, of course, it was immediately turned into a racial thing. And, you know, there are arguments on both sides of that. There's no question that the police in many parts of the U.S. are being militarized. I mean, they're getting all this free federal military equipment coming back from the Middle East, and they got all these armored tanks and carriers and high-caliber weapons, and, you know, they're converting our police into soldiers rather than police officers. They're being trained for military operations and not protection of the public operations. And so that's all very true on the one side, and there's no doubt that that played a role in this thing. On the other hand, there's a lot of violence going on the streets because of this tragic shooting of this kid. Now there are thousands of people out there rioting and destroying property and looting stores and all that sort of thing. So it's bad, you know, and that's the sort of thing we have to deal with all the time. It's just more bad news and the breakdown of common sense and all that sort of thing.
Just seems to me that they're turning posse comitatus into posses full of commies that harm us.
Yeah, well, it's happening. And, you know, and it's tragic, and I don't know that there's any quick answer to it, but I do know that this is not a race issue or should not be a race issue. They're making it into one. Our media has plays a rather unsavory role in doing that sort of thing. I doubt very much that the policeman that killed this kid did so because his skin was black. I mean, but that's what they're trying to make it out to be. He shouldn't have shot the kid. There's no question about that. And I'm not justifying it, but I don't think it was a race issue. But anyway, you know how the media works. It's more sensational to perpetuate certain storylines, and that's one of the more popular ones. So anyway, that's what we deal with. And on the larger scale, though, on things that might even be of more interest to you folks where you are, is the fact that we're in the early stages of producing a documentary film called Black Start. And Black Start is the code name used in the electrical power industry to describe the procedure by which the power grid can be brought back online successfully after it's been completely shut down, either by an EMP attack, weapon attack, or by an extremely powerful X-class solar flare. Now, these are topics that, well, people have heard about the EMP, but not many people are aware of the solar flare issue. It hasn't received a lot of publicity, and in my view, it's very, very serious because EMPs could happen. There's no question about it. But this killer solar flare will happen. There's no question that it will happen, and we're overdue right now. These monstrous X-class flares happen about every 150 years. And it's been 150.
I recall pictures of like in the 1800s or something like that when they first put telegraph poles up. There was a big flare and everything got wiped out in the States.
Yeah, that was 150 years ago, and of course that was before the age of the power grid. So we've had these before, but there was no power grid around them. And the fact is that these thousands and thousands of miles of wires that stretch all over the civilized world, so-called civilized world, act like an antenna, and they will pick up the electromagnetic surge that comes and hits the Earth from one of these powerful solar flares. They say that the solar flares are going off all the time, but most of them are not really of this magnitude that we're talking about. And of those that are, most of them miss the Earth because the Earth is kind of a small target, you know. When these flares are shooting off 180 degrees and, you know, in all directions, it's pretty easy to miss the Earth. But as I said, about every 150 years, one will hit the Earth. And the last one was 155 years ago. So statistically speaking, we're overdue. And the bottom line is that if one were to hit today, the grid is not protected against them, and it will go down. And I'm not just talking going down for a couple of hours or a few days or a week. I'm talking about 2 years or more. Because the thing that will be destroyed, or the things that will be destroyed, are the massive main transformers that exist at all of the power generating stations and in some of the substations. Those will be burnt to a crisp. And they don't have those sitting around on a shelf as spare parts like they do for those transformers that sit on your telephone pole in your neighborhood. These puppies have to be manufactured to special requirements. No two of them are the same. Most of them are made in Korea or even in China. I can imagine them helping us out, you know. And right now it takes a year to 2 years to get one made after the order is placed. And can you imagine if 100 of them went down at the same time, how long that would take? So the bottom line is that the grid is terribly unprotected right now. It can be protected. There are ways to do it, and it's affordable, but neither government nor the power industry is really doing anything about it. They're playing political games and corporate games, and meanwhile, we're sitting here like sitting ducks, waiting for that solar storm to hit, or the EMP, and if it should happen, believe me, it's going to be one of the worst events of all recorded history, and nobody is talking about it. So if you want something to think about, that's it.
Do you believe that they might actually be trying to keep this under wraps or not actually trying to prepare anything for it? Because a collapse of the power grid would also restructure the entirety of society in terms of how much power people actually have in a very literal, in a political sense of the word. He who has power is the one in power. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. It's not an impossible scenario at all. As a matter of fact, that is one of the options that an intelligent person would have to consider. Are they deliberately dragging their feet? And it's a horrible option to consider because why would they want to do that? Well, you just said it. First of all, there are a lot of people in pretty high places that would like to see the population greatly reduced, right? That's one of the reasons, they're talking about poisonous medications and vaccinations and all this sort of thing. And I believe that's one of the reasons, or at least a spin-off advantage for some of the chemtrails we're seeing. It reduces the immune resistance of the human race. It reduces fertility. All of this fluoridation in our water supply is not for dental health. It's to reduce fertility, reduce the population. Well, I'm here to tell you that if the power grid goes down in a large area, say the United States or in New Zealand, the whole country goes down, 80%, probably 90% of the population would not survive more than a month. Now you talk about population reduction. This would make some people happy, and the ones in control in the government and in the top echelons of the industry, they know all about this. And interestingly enough, at least here in the United States, they've taken care of themselves. Their institutions, their power generators, their private systems, their bunkers and everything are all set up under the name of continuity of government. They'll survive and their families, or the rest of us are hung out to dry, you know, and they're not doing anything about it. So that's one scenario. I'm not saying I believe it, but one has to consider it as a possibility. Mm. There are those people that would like to see a reduction of the population. And the other group would like to see martial law, wouldn't they? So they can clamp down on the last vestiges of individual liberties and freedoms, and they'd have a perfectly good excuse. People would say, oh, come, please save us. We need drinking water. We need food. We don't care. You put us in a truck. Take us to a camp.
Somewhere to keep us safe, like you kept the Jews safe.
Yeah. And you know, it would be valid because people would be dropping like flies. When you're dying of thirst, I don't know where people would get their drinking water if it didn't come out of a pipe, especially those living in the cities, you know. Anyway.
What are they going to do, resort to urine therapy?
It would be what?
They're probably just going to have to resort to urine therapy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that. How long would that last? Well, we've seen examples of that around the world, you know, and it doesn't last very long. People, they revert into a barbaric stage. People kill each other just for basic food and water. And
a survivalist once told me that the most dangerous thing in a survival situation is not a militarized police or government or anything. It's merely a man with hungry kids.
That's right. So, frankly, the bottom line of this documentary that we're producing is not how to prepare for that, because I don't think that's a realistic scenario. You can't prepare for that. You might stockpile water and food in your house, but the guy next door with the hungry kids, as you just said, he's got to feed that family and so forth. So that's not how you survive. What we need to focus on is get those darn transformers protected. Let's get off the dime here and make these politicians and corporate executives responsible for you know, make them do what they can do, what they should do, and they know how to do it. We've got the technology, the equipment is available. The cost of it would be pretty high, be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, but spread out over the population would be about the cost of one Starbucks every 2 or 3 months. So it's affordable. It can be done. And when you think of the vast amounts of money that governments are wasting on less honorable purposes, nobody can say that we can't afford it.
I've always said that disasters take a hell of a lot more resources to clean up once they've happened than they take to prevent. And, you know, you take the any oil spill in the world. Man, maybe it's a good idea to send some divers underneath there to make sure that we don't have a leak in the boat. Nah, she'll be right. Boom! And then...
Yeah, well, there you go, Vinny. You're making sense. We got to get you off the air.
Well, you know, again, are we getting hazard pay for this, Ed?
You know, are we what?
Are we getting hazard pay for this? You know, tell her the
hazard
truth
pay?
And whatnot.
Oh, boy, if we got hazard pay, we'd be rich.
Yeah. You know, I mean, just get a royalty check every month from criminal sociopaths would be great.
Okay, I'm ready.
Yeah. Speaking of criminal sociopaths, we were talking about the race riots that are happening in the States right now and the militarized police. And I was just thinking about this. What if they're playing the long game? What if these two things that are seemingly have no connection whatsoever actually do have a wee bit connection? What if they're really, really trying to amp up the martial law and the militarization and all of that kind of stuff? Maybe there's even a contingency plan in preparation for this big EMP burst that we might suffer. And with a militarized police to control the population and kill anybody who resists, I think
well,
they might actually
hold
it
right have
it there, in the bag.
Yeah, hold it right there, because if you just take off the word maybe, you're correct. There's no maybe about it. There are contingency plans. As a matter of fact, every once in a while they hold training exercises and drills for just exactly what you're talking about. I've forgotten the date, but there's one established coming up pretty soon here in the States. Every major city in the United States will be mobilized. All the emergency services will be mobilized. The mayor, the police, the National Guard, you know, the utility companies, the fire departments, they'll all be mobilized, and they'll stage an event like this just to make sure that everybody knows what they're supposed to do, where they're supposed to go, and, you know, they got their manuals they have to get out and read. This is all done. They're just waiting for a real event.
Or they're waiting for a staged event.
A staged event. That would, yeah, I wish I could remove that from the list of options, but we have to keep it on the list.
Yeah. Well, I think whenever you're trying to analyze the government or the people that run our countries and basically own us as serf slaves, if you assume the worst and then assume that it's probably 1,000 times worse than you originally assumed, it's close to the truth.
Oh, what a pessimist you are.
that's just me being optimistic, you know. I mean,
I know. And I think it's being realistic. Yes, that's the way the universe is.
Well, you see, if I said it's 1,000 times worse than I could ever imagine, that's me being optimistic. If I said it's 1,000,000,000 times worse than I could possibly imagine, that's
okay.
Realistic. You know?
Now you've gone over the edge. That's
you know, somebody stop me. Okay, we will be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with G. Edward Griffin from Freedom Force International, the Reality Zone, and various other nice adjectives. And you can go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, ladies and gentlemen, and either sign up to give a regular donation today to support this broadcast and the general exposure of scumbaggery that we do here on a daily basis. Or you can check out some of our sponsors there. We've got the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn there. Pop Round, and they've got a lot of cannabis information and indeed Green Cross evenings there, as well as the Blue Shield to protect yourself from EMF and EMR wireless radiation. That's kind of nasty stuff, and they're just doing some blood tests on the products now with pretty good results. The one thing I always like to mention is they originally developed it for cows, and they put these little EMF blockers on these cows' necks, and they found out that they produced about 10% more milk. Hey, that's got to be good for you, especially if you're lactating. We'll be right back.
Oh, and I'm on my way to believing.
Listen, damn it. You step outside, you risk your life. You take a drink of water, you risk your life. And nowadays you breathe, and you risk your life. Every moment now. You don't have a choice. The only thing you can choose is what you're risking it for. Now, I can make these people feel better and hang on a little bit longer. I can save lives. That's reason enough to risk mine. And you know that.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand in the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland. Speaking about fluoridation, you know what's really interesting? The only people in favour of fluoridation seem to be, let's say the authorities in terms of the favour on fluoridation, right? Seem to be dentists. Now, are dentists toxicologists? No, they're not. Then what the hell would they know about toxins that you swallow? They wouldn't know anything about... That's right! Oh, my God. It's like going to a mechanic when your liver's acting up. It's frickin' stupid, man. My very special guest is G. Edward Griffin. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You know, I got a comment on this fluoridation issue. I came across a very interesting paper. Had I known we were going to talk about it, I would have dug it out. But if any of your listeners are interested and they write in, I'll see that you get the reference later. But anyway, it's a scientific paper. It's on the internet and has a very long, boring title. But it was all about the relationship between the decline in fertility rates and the application of fluoridation in public water systems globally. And some poor sap, I don't think he got a doctorate degree on it, but he certainly should have, or several of them, because he analyzed all of the fertility rates and the dates on which fluoridated water was introduced and so forth, and came up with an amazing conclusion, more than a conclusion, a statistical proof that the fertility rate went down within, I think he said within a year, after fluoridating the water. And it went from a rate which was generally considered by population control authorities as being too high. We were having too much population, but after fluoridation was introduced to the water system, it came down to a nice comfortable level of at the right level or maybe a little bit below replication rate, so that the population is actually declining. And his conclusion was that, hey, this couldn't be an accident. I mean, we can't think of any real scientific reason for fluoridating the water, except the now disproven claim that it's good for preventing dental caries. I mean, that's what they used to say, but nobody really says that anymore because the evidence disproves that. So what's left? Nobody's got anything left unless you conclude that the authorities that are passing on these things have got this agenda that, well, we can't talk openly about it because all these people get upset if they find out that we're messing with their fertility rate. But nevertheless, we, the elites, we who know these things, know that the population has to be reduced, and this is a good way to do it because this way we don't have to kill anybody. We just prevent them from being born. So it's this is a very important fact, I think, and people should be aware of it when they're talking about fluoridated water.
I'm just seeing here the cover of The Economist magazine that says Falling Fertility, How the Population Problem is Solving Itself. Now, by the implications there, having a population seems to be a problem for the economy.
Yeah. And there are two implications there. That's one of them. It's absurd, isn't it, that a falling population rate is good for the economy. And the other is that somehow this reduced population rate is tied to education or higher level of industrial productivity or some other measurement of society, when in fact it's no such thing. It's just tied to the amount of fluoride in the water.
Well, there's actually a range of Oh, of course, you know this. There's a range of anti-fertility things that are being done to people. I mean, diet can reduce your fertility. How many fast food chains are there in the United States now versus 1950? Yep, there's one element there. Bisophenylalanine, BPA, which is in all plastics and printer inks, the inks that reduces male fertility and gives women breast cancer. How many people are eating stuff out of plastic now? How many people are touching stuff that's printed, like a newspaper? Are you reading it? That'll teach you if you're trying to be informed. and then what else have we got here? Goodness knows what. The vaccines or obviously the fluoride's one. But in my opinion, and I think this is echoed by a researcher named Kevin Galilee, that there is a population control agenda that is multifaceted and totally covert, and it infects every single element of our lives, which is why almost every single country the whole world over has plummeting fertility rates. I mean, in order for a society to prevent its extinction, statistically, 2.4 children. That's what everybody needs to have. It's now like 1.1 in Europe, and it's like 1.2 or 1.4 in the United States, and similar around the Western world. We're being covertly exterminated, right? That's my opinion of it, and that's, of course, just trying to be optimistic.
Yeah, well, I guess they're having that problem in China right now. They've been, pursuing this one-child policy for so many years, and now the reality has hit some of the communist leaders there that, oh my gosh, our population is rapidly declining, and we're not, in a couple of more years, we're not going to have enough workers to push into our hot little factories and be competitive in the world, and we better reverse this. And so they're beginning to back off on that and make it sound as though it's because they're concerned with personal choice and personal liberty, when in fact it's got nothing to do except they're worried about their declining population.
I do think that this is absolutely true, and Japan's been suffering this problem for a long, long time. They've always had relatively low fertility, and they've got, like, in some cases, 3rd, 4th, even 5th, or 6th generations of families paying off the same house in Tokyo. Yeah. You know,
yeah,
it's not working too well. And so what people do is they go, well, you know, what'll be the solution to us not being able to have any children? Let's bring people from other countries in. Let's bring in immigrants who are unfamiliar with the culture or don't speak the language or whatever, and we'll pay them peanuts and we can do all of this. And then as a result, what happens? The local population starts fomenting this massive racial hatred kind of thing, and then it gets everybody, including the new immigrants and the people who've been there the whole time, fighting with each other, and then they forget that it's the government who's screwing them both over.
Mm. Yep, I certainly can see that. It's everywhere. Well, at least it's in those countries which are supposedly civilized, where there's high technology. The rate of technology is directly tied to the declining rate of fertility. In the countries which have low technology, in some of those countries what we would call third world and so forth, the population is still expanding. But as the technology increases, as the level of civilization, so-called, goes up, and there's more fast food and more government controls over the water supply and all of that sort of thing, as technology increases and as government controls increase and regulations increase, supposedly to protect the people, that's when the fertility goes down.
Mm. And let's not forget one of the most major unseen, and I'm talking literally unseen factors here in fertility, is all the wireless and dirty electricity that's in the air. I mean, right now, if you whipped out one of those devices, some people who have just wireless coming off their internet router or something like that, you're bathing in about 15,000 microwatts. You know,
have you got a
Bluetooth wireless Mac mouse or something like that, bro? That by itself is 8,000 microwatts plus a keyboard. That's another 8,000. And with these signals, the real problem is you don't just get the highest signal and that's what interprets everything for you. It's actually all cumulative, and it has a massive, massive effect on fertility. Having a laptop on your lap for 30 seconds kills every bit of sperm.
Right. 30 seconds.
Something like that. Something ridiculous.
Well, you're talking to the choir here, because I'm one of those guys that keeps my Wi-Fi turned off all the time, you know. except when absolutely necessary, like in an airport and I need to get online. But that little blue light always bothers me, and I try and turn it off. So I know what you're talking about, Vinny, and I think you're 100% accurate.
Now, it's cumulative causation. You know, everything's sort of like stacking together. It reminds me of an episode of The Simpsons where Mr. Burns gets really, really sick. You know, he's the head honcho of the thing. But the problem is he's got so many diseases that they all cancel each other out, like about 20 people trying to get through a doorway. They all get stuck in the doorway. none of them come through. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way, ladies and gentlemen. You're screwed, right? You know? And the thing is, as mature adults, we need to accept the reality of the situation and then do something about it. Don't accept the reality of the situation and then fool yourself into thinking there's nothing you can do about it. That's the most dangerous thing you can do.
Well, you know, I agree with that totally. You and I don't think you're going to find anything to argue about. Can we pick something that we disagree on? Let's see, what would that be?
Well, ironically, the things that we disagree on probably non-existent. I mean, we might get lucky, but ultimately, it seems if you come from the same wavelength, for example, freedom, justice, equality, often you won't have fundamental disagreements with people about anything, right? As I ask people, I say, hey, bro, if the government told you to, would you put on a black mask and go kill innocent women and children and things of that nature just because the government told you to? You go, no. Well, then we don't have any real fundamental disagreements here. There's many people who will, on the other hand. Now, here's an element that I'd actually like you to explain to the audience. You talk about cultural development. You talk about our current society. What would our culture look like if we took everything that's currently in it today, revamped it, changed it? If you had the power to change it, what would you do for people? What would you, you know, if you were a politician or whatever, in terms of the very structure of society, how would you change it? How would you make it better? How would you make it into an actual culture rather than a cult?
Well, I think that's an easy question to answer because I've given that a lot of thought. And I'm going to give you the answer to that, but then there's a follow-up question, which is, well, how do you do that? I know what has to be done, but the question of how you do it is a very ponderous one. What I would do, I would somehow hypnotize the entire population to appreciate the value of freedom, to appreciate the value of individual freedom as opposed to domination by the group and the dynamics of the group being the ultimate power of society. You know, we speak about this a lot in Freedom Force International, that the center of society, in our view, is the individual, not the group. But the world looks at it differently today. Practically every major country in the world is based on the model of collectivism, which teaches that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. And it's on that idea that I believe most, if not all, of the great ills of the world are based, because the charlatans and the evil people, the con artists who gravitate into government, can convince the people that any atrocity, I don't care what it is in their own good, or at least it's in the good, the greater good of society. The
Could
greater
I interject?
Good of the greater number.
I've always found it very interesting how when leaders talk about sacrifices having to be made, they're never talking about self-sacrifice.
Oh no! It's a sacrifice for you and for me and the citizen, and they're the wise ones who will decide who makes the sacrifice, how great a sacrifice, and when. You know,
I mean,
so that,
haven't
you
we...
Know, we could talk about the errors of that point of view, but that's the point of view that I believe is at the core of all of the problems. And so, if I could wave this spiral, revolving image that would hypnotize everybody and say, oh yes, I realize now that's wrong. The individual is this cornerstone of society, and the greater good of the greater number is accomplished by protecting the rights of the individual. If I could make them realize that, then I think this would profoundly change society. We would recognize then that the proper function of the state is only to use violence if necessary for the defense of life, liberty, and property, and nothing else. Nothing else. We cannot use force or violence to compel people to go to church on Sunday, or not to open their shop on Sunday, or to hire a certain person because there's a quota, or to take care of somebody else's medical bills because they need it, or to pay for somebody's education, or to make them think or act or live or work in a special way. Our only use of force is negative. To defend life, liberty, and property, nothing more. That's what I would do if I could effect a change in everybody's thinking, and it would revolutionize this planet.
People like you and I wouldn't do well in Aztec culture, I found, you know. Hey, everybody, sacrifices have to be made. You, over there.
Yeah, well, that's how it works. Yeah.
It is actually down to its core precisely the operation of it. And what you're saying here kind of speaks to me a little bit fantastically, because we're talking about the initiation of force. Okay, so let's take it down to its brass tacks. Right, so you want education to be better. Okay, you got your child in front of you who's uneducated. All right, point a gun at them and say, read this book. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that effective? It actually is, because the child will read the book because you force them to.
Yeah.
Now, option two, put the book in front of the child. Explain to them what the book is. Teach them how to read if they want to, and then say, you can actually learn a lot from this book, and you can not only help yourself, but you can help others, and calmly, rationally explain it. Right?
Well, what you have there, Vinny, is that's the foundation of freedom, the foundation of individualism, and you're confronted with the obvious fact that not every child will want to read a book, and that child will probably grow up illiterate. And the collectivists say, ah, there you see, you failed. You failed because we have maybe 5, 10, 12% of the population that's illiterate. They don't read. And I would say, well, seems like it failed, but we got 100% of the population that's free, my friend. And I'll take freedom any day, freedom to fail, freedom to make mistakes. If you don't have the freedom to make mistakes, then you don't have freedom, because somebody else will determine what is a mistake and what is not. So freedom has its price. And the good thing about making a mistake in freedom is that you now have the freedom to correct that mistake. And you can go back and say, well, that was wrong. Now I'm going to try it differently. And you don't need permission from the government. You don't need some bureaucracy giving you a permit or a license or an allocation or funding or anything like that. You just do it because that's what you feel from your experience and your observation that that's the right thing to do.
I mean, that whole basic non-aggression principle, I don't think is taught or very well understood these days, is it?
No, it's not taught at all. In fact, you'd be surprised how many people, and I get into this, as you know, quite often, when people balk at the idea of letting other people make mistakes. And I say, you don't really believe in freedom, do you? And they have to look at me and they say, well, no. Because they think that freedom to make a mistake is impermissible. You can't do that. You can't let people make a mistake. And they assume with that they're going to be the ones in charge who determines what a mistake is. They never think that maybe they're the ones who want to do something and someone else is saying, nope, that's a mistake. And, you know, they always figure that they're going to be the ones who are the wise ones and the ones making the decision. They never see that they're going to be at the small end.
It's a self-interest, narcissistic sort of society that's been built up. Now, in terms of spirituality, I've started to look into a little bit of these things. Now, the type of mindset of the people that are doing this kind of collectivist indoctrination, scumbaggery, assassinations, you know, the whole gamut of basically evil power and corruption, etc., they seem to just basically be classic psychopaths to me, you know, at best corporate psychopaths who are very buttoned down, extremely charming, but are a hell of a lot more dangerous than the obvious psychopaths who will just like maybe hurt somebody with a hammer or whatever. These guys will blow up your country and laugh, you know. And it seems to me to be a spiritual thing as well as a political thing as well as a psychological thing, as if these three elements have actually been combined, almost as if a demon's been sent to Earth, possessed of a powerful person from a lineage of a bloodline or something like that, and then use their possession of this individual in order to create hell on Earth. What would your opinion of that be?
Well, I don't know about the demon aspect or the spiritual aspect in that context. I certainly believe that this is a spiritual conflict that we're engaged in, but I don't know whether that transfers into spirit beings with a will and intelligence and that sort of thing. I don't know. I just don't know. But I certainly agree that the evidence it would be the same whether it is or is not. I think that if we looked at the population at large, probably my estimation is that about 15%, 10 to 15% of the entire population has an aggressive instinct. They're predators. They have a predator instinct, stronger than the rest of the population. And these are the people that want what you've got. I mean, you know, as little kids, we're all predators, right? We'd like to have something, and we just go take it until we're slapped on the wrist or patted on the fanny, and it's shown to us that that's not a good policy. And gradually, as we grow older, then we learn from experience that that's not a good policy because it violates our own enlightened self-interest. We learn that, but when we come out of the womb, we don't know that, and we're just aggressive little thieves. And but I think some people have that instinct stronger than others, or maybe they just never get over it. But regardless, there's about 15% out there who have this predator instinct, and they gravitate into any position of power that allows them protection to be aggressive and to be a predator without violating laws and without paying the price. And so they gravitate into politics, they gravitate up to the tops of corporations. They are the ones who want the power over us. And so and the rest of us who are not aggressive or not at least predators, we're content to just live and let live. And meanwhile, then at some point in our lives, we look around and say, hey, what happened? How come all these guys up there where the power is, how come they're all doing these bad things to me? I don't understand that. Is because we don't realize that there are different classes of people in this sense. There is a predator class, and we have to design a system that makes it difficult, if not impossible, for predators to seize control of power and use it against us. It's one of our responsibilities if we want to remain free.
The Founding Fathers knew this very well, which is why they specifically stipulated that if the government turns tyrannical, it's your right. No, actually, I think they use the word duty to overthrow such government, isn't it? Right?
Well, that's what they said. Yes, and it even goes deeper than that. And what about not overthrowing it, but just protecting it so that it doesn't get that way? If you remember, shortly after the Constitution was, the American Constitution was drafted and signed, Thomas Jefferson got a letter from a friend of his who was a doctor, and it's been published in the Jefferson collection. And the doctor said, well, Mr. Jefferson, so you've given us a republic of limited powers, and that all is very well and good, but how can we be sure that only good men are elected to positions of authority? And Jefferson's reply was classic. He said, speak to me not of good men. Rather, let us bind men down with the chains of the Constitution. In other words, he was saying, what are you talking about, good men? We're not going to have good men in government. It's not going to happen, Charlie. We're going to get evil men in government, so prepare for it. Make sure that once they're there, they're bound down by the chains of the Constitution, the rules and regulations that prevent them from using power against the common people. And that's the whole purpose of drafting an airtight Constitution.
That's so funny because I actually had a braingasm one day, and I was like, you know, it would be really great if when we elect a politician, they get given a uniform, like a black and white stripy jumpsuit, and we attach a ball and chain to their ankle, and then we handcuff them to a desk and say, you're a public servant now. You got no power, bro. We're just taking away from you. All right, we'll be back after the break in a minute, ladies and gentlemen. But this reminds me of a scene from The Matrix. Excuse me, when Morpheus is teaching Neo something in the agent's training room, and he says to him, "These guys are holding all the keys. They're guarding all the doors, which means that eventually someone is going to have to fight them." We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. This is a listener-supported broadcast. You can either start donating a few dollars a month or whatever into the Kiwi Bank or the PayPal account, or just make a one-off donation. And we also have a couple of great sponsors on the homepage as well. Blue Shield, to protect yourself from that nasty EMF and wireless radiation. There's also a book on there, the Crowdfunding Revolution. So if you want to learn how to actually fund any operation that you want using crowdsourcing, which is the new form of capitalism that's been given to us by the internet, more or less, go for your life, son. Pick up one of those books. Other than that, please go to the High Tea Cafe or the Gourmet Soap Kitchen in Wagga Wagga, with banners on the homepage there at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. We'll be right back with G. Edward Griffin.
The pioneers gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build our new West. They were determined to make the new world strong and free, an example to the world. Some would say that those struggles are all over, that all the horizons have been explored, that all the battles have been won, that there is no longer an American frontier. And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of unknown opportunities and peril. Beyond that frontier are uncharted areas of science and space, unsolved problems of peace and war, unconquered province of ignorance and prejudice. I'm asking each of you to be pioneers towards that new frontier. My call is to the young in heart, regardless of age. Can we carry through in an age where we will witness not only new breakthroughs in weapons of destruction, but also a race for mastery of the sky and the rain, the ocean and the tides, the far side of space, and the inside of men's minds? All mankind waits upon our decision. A whole world looks to see what we shall do. And we cannot fail that trust, and we cannot fail to try.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's our final segment with Ed Griffin here, otherwise known as G. Edward Griffin. The G stands for Straight Up Gangster. And could you give us your websites there, Ed?
Ed, me the real G? Well, it stands for George, but don't tell anyone.
Apparently, like you had two father grandfather before you that were all named George, and you're just like, I want to be original.
You got it. Yeah, my father was George. My grandfather was George. In fact, my grandfather was George Edward, the same as mine. I'm named after him. So George got to be a little confusing.
It's kind of like in Australia, because everybody's named Bruce.
I thought they were sort of named Mike.
Well, either that. Who knows, you know. You know what the difference is between Australia and cheese?
What?
If you leave cheese in the desert for 200 years, it develops some form of culture.
That's very good.
I thought so. All right, anyway, your website's in, please, before we forget.
My website, oh yes. Well, thanks for that. Yeah, the commercial website where we sell things. We sell books and recordings and, you know, videos and CDs. It's called Reality Zone. Real easy to remember. It's realityzone.com. And we've got about, close to 100 different items there. And there's something there for everyone. And we dump it all in there if we think it's got value and it's correct. And, you know, no propaganda, no twist to it. That's where it ends up. So that's realityzone.com. And then our think tank website, Vinny, as you know, is Freedom Force. And that's where we have nothing to sell except ideas. And we kick around a lot of ideas, and we try and figure out how to solve these problems and what a better future would look like and how it would operate and so forth. So anyone that's interested in becoming part of the solution, instead of just complaining about the problem, should go to freedomforceinternational.org. freedomforceinternational.org.
Okay, well, there's the websites for you, ladies and gentlemen. I suggest you go there and check them out, get informed, and that kind of jazz. Also, the DVD you sent me a long time ago was the Red Pill DVD or something? It had a whole accumulation of documentaries and things of that nature. And what occurred to me, Ed, is that you've been in this movement trying to expose what people are exposing today for much, much longer. Since back in the 70s, you've been giving presentations like the Carol Quigley presentation. I thought that you did was quite exceptional. And basically, you've been ahead of your time for quite some time. You know what I'm saying?
I sure do. It's been a long path. I first began to speak out on these issues actually in 1960. My first book was published in 1964, and it's been downhill ever since. You know, once you get to that point, you can't let go of it. So, yes, it's been a long time.
Well, you feel kind of like the truther slash Michael Jackson effect. You know how Michael Jackson never had a childhood, you know? You never had that irresponsibility of youth. Did you ever get the irresponsibility chance, you know, to be one of the normal people in society who don't care, don't do anything, don't think for themselves, and just go about having fun with your life? Or did you just kind of miss out on that?
No, I didn't miss out on that. I did all of that in spades. Yeah, well, I didn't really wake up to any of this till I was married, and I had a couple of kids, and I went through all of that in my youth, and went to school, and did all the things I shouldn't have done, and graduated, and got married, had a couple of children, and then began to look seriously at the world. So, and that all happened. That awakening began in 1960.
Was there something that perked your curiosity? Because for me, it was a friend introduced me to Michael Rupert from thewilderness.com. He's not here anymore, doing a presentation called The Truth and Lies of 9/11. And then I also got arrested for selling cannabis when I was a lot younger, and that kind of prompted me again. That huge kind of shock catapulted me and made me change the direction of my life. Was there anything like that for you, or was it just like, oh, that's an interesting article, I'll read further, and then it just goes from there?
Yeah, it was more like that, Vinny. There was no catapult. It was just sort of like a slippery slope, you know. The first information I came across that was different was published by an organization called the Foundation for Economic Education, put out by that organization there in Irvington on Hudson in New York. They published a magazine called The Free Man, and it was just a little Reader's Digest type of magazine with articles in it relating to the free market and free enterprise and that kind of thing, which I certainly did not. I was not exposed to any of that in college, and it was all collectivist-oriented in college. So this was new, and I started to read it, and I subscribed, and then I ran into Robert Welch, who was the founder of the John Birch Society, which got to be very controversial in the late 1960s. And I started to read all the material that they had. And what really got me, I have to tell you the truth, is because I thought what they were putting out was pretty sound and very conservative and very restrained. There was no speculation. Everything was documented. And yet the way the media came out and portrayed that group as a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes and racists and radicals and they didn't use the word terrorists, but if that had been popular, they would have done that too. And they completely demonized this little educational group. And I thought, wow, if the media can do that, if they can create that lie and convince just about every American that this group was dangerous to their freedom, when it was just a little educational group that was promoting the ideas of freedom, that's when I really realized the power of this force that we were up against. And that's when I really got activated and made this my full time. My life at that point changed.
Did your social circles change like it does for many people? Like for me, I am no longer close friends with anybody that I was close friends with prior to waking up to the truth.
Yeah, that definitely happened to me, and I think it happens to most people. It definitely happened, and at first it hurt me a little bit because I had some good friends that began to think that they didn't want to discuss these issues. I don't think they really thought I was wrong, but they were overly influenced by all this newspaper propaganda that I was mentioning just a moment ago. You know, the old idea, well, if there's smoke, there must be fire. So, you know, if this group was being claimed to be anti-Semitic and I was a part of it, that must make me anti-Semitic, you know. It was that sort of reasoning. And I thought, oh, my gosh, these people are just, well, I don't have much in common with them anymore. So that's the way it happened.
It is, and I think it's like when your interests change, and the analogy I like to use to explain this to truth is about what happens to them once you find out that you no longer have anything in common with your friends, because your friend's thinking process no longer has anything in common with reality, and you refuse to accept that as your social circle. Is actually when they more or less legalized cannabis production in the Netherlands. And the reason I say this is because it's a very similar phenomenon, or at least to my mind, because before the legalization of it, before it was all readily accepted and everybody was going on about it, i.e. this is like the truth, there was actually more people doing cannabis, as in about maybe 20% of the population. After they did that, they reduced that by two-thirds. And afterwards, the government did a survey about all these people who gave up smoking cannabis after it was legal. You know, like, how could that happen? And they say, because my social circles changed, because I was no longer a forcible criminal, right? I was no longer forced to associate with other criminals exclusively to buy or use cannabis with them. And I realized that I had nothing in common with them apart from getting high. And I made some better friends. And that's kind of how society works.
That's a very good story. I hadn't heard that one before, but I can see how that would definitely happen. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, that's how it happened to me. And each little step was kind of a small one, but when you look backwards and realize how many steps were taken, I certainly have come a long way from where I started.
Did you have a great friend who you sort of like looked up to in the movement when you first started out? Because for me it was the editor of Uncensored Magazine, John Eisen, who's still a very good friend today, and he sort of helped me, encouraged me, and inspired me a little bit to go off and do things of my own. And was there a similar person like that for you to encourage you?
Well, there were many people like that. I became an avid reader, and it seemed like after I finished reading a book, the author of that book was my latest hero, you know. I thought, wow, he really did a great job on that. And looking back on it, I mentioned Robert Welch before. He was a great intellect and a very well-educated person. And I was impressed by that, and I was impressed by the depth of his analysis of world affairs and so forth. And so I think I was greatly influenced by his scholarship and all that. There was a fellow by the name of Dan Smoot, who was a former FBI agent who left the agency and began to write his own newsletter. He called it the Dan Smoot Report, and he was on television for a while. And I learned a lot from him because of his excellent organization of material and his ability to document everything he knew in advance when somebody would object, you know, he knew when people would say, oh, I don't believe that. And so he anticipated that. And just before you can hardly get those thoughts into your mind, bingo, there's a footnote. And you can go and look it up and go to the original source and so forth. So Dan Smoot was one of those people. And there were many of them along the way. And yeah, and I think it's important to recognize that we, you know, it's an old saying, and it's true that we stand on the shoulders of giants. None of us are what we are because of just what we did, but, you know, we stand on the work that's been done by others before us.
Do you accept that you're actually now one of those giants for whom others stand upon?
No, I don't think so. People tend to picture me in that mode, mainly because I think of my age. I've been around longer than anyone, it seems. And that seems to have some coinage value there. But no, I pulled together the information that's gone, been written down or spoken before me. And if there's anything I do contribute to it, it would be maybe a talent for organizing it and streamlining it and maybe rephrasing it so it's maybe a little more clear to understand than in the original form. But as for substance, there's very little that I could look at and say, well, that's all mine. That's, you know, that's my original work. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, you know, you can't take credit for other people's work. It's sort of like, I consider as a radio show host and filmmaker that the vast majority of my content is basically me just interviewing people who've actually done the work. I'm more or less just a third party recording what they're saying and allowing their research to be published on a YouTube channel and so on. I believe it's a symbiotic relationship between the activist media and the activists and researchers, etc., themselves. It's almost like one would not exist without the other, or at least be a hell of a lot less effective, because without researchers to interview, I wouldn't have anything to publish. And without interviewers to publish their content, the researchers would never get heard.
Right. Well, that's kind of the role that an author plays, except, you know, I use the printed page and you use the airwaves. And we draw on the works and wisdom of others and package it and maybe add a little bit of interpretation and clarification of our own as we go. And that's our role.
I feel as an interviewer, I haven't really earned any of the knowledge that I currently possess. It's all been given to me freely by my elders, who have actually often had to do incredibly large quantities of hard work, research, and in many cases, incarceration and suffering to know these things that they do.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing like a first-person account of an event that they live through. It's unbeatable.
One other element I'd like to really open up here with you is in terms of inspiring other people, because I've felt for a long time, and I think this is the reason why I started up, I'm going to get your perspective on it, the reason I started up doing all this media stuff in New Zealand was because I'd basically listened to a lot of Alex Jones. I was getting really, really angry. But I wasn't doing anything positive with that information. I wasn't actually helping anybody with these things that I knew. And I realized there was no Alex Jones of New Zealand or anything even close to that. And I knew that I wasn't him either. But I wanted to do what he was doing, is just give all those people a platform to speak where the mainstream media would either give them 2 minutes or give them nothing.
Well, yeah, I think you made a very good analysis and appraisal of the situation, and you made the right move, Vinny. You know, sometimes I get a little impatient with the movement, if I can call it that, put quote marks around it, because people are just talking about the problem, and very little time is spent on, well, okay, what are we going to do about it? I get frustrated and angry, and then I have to stop and realize, well, wait a minute. The problem is old stuff to me, maybe to you, but out there in your radio audience and out there on the people who stumble across my book, they don't really know yet about all of these problems, and somebody has to explain it to them. If they don't have that information, then it's impossible for them to figure out down the line what to do about it. So it's an important part of the whole, the whole landscape of a solution. You've got to have public understanding before the public will be ready for a solution.
I have had that thought occur to me, and what I actually sort of managed to encapsulate it is, when I talk about a problem, somebody, occasionally this happens, I'm sure you've experienced this, somebody comes up and they ignore everything and every bit of analysis that you've got about the problem. Okay, they almost pretend that it doesn't exist, even though they're listening to you talk about it. And then their first comment is, what is the solution? I don't know what you're talking about. I don't care. I don't want to listen. But what I do want is for you to solve all my problems for me like a frickin' messiah. That's what that phrase says to me.
Yeah. Well, that represents, I think, a large cross-section of the population, which makes it so dangerous, because that always, in the past, historically, that leads to a revolt against established tyranny, the rise of a man on a white horse, not too much explanation, just ride the wave of passion and anger and hatred and say, okay, let's get rid of this tyrant, you follow me. And nobody asks what that me is like and what he believes in. And so they follow the guy on the white horse, and the first thing you know, they overthrow the old tyrant, but they got a new one that's just as bad as the old one, if not worse.
Well, you know, they say a bit of the dip. There's so many of these cliche excuses, haven't you noticed it, Ed? Like, all these kind of like, it's really difficult knowing what you're talking about, because then your brain automatically, it's sort of like if you can't speak French, but now you can, every time somebody speaks French to you, you can now understand it and interpret the signal properly, you know, and get the meaning. When people say taxation, it means a different thing to me to what it used to. When people say education, it means a different thing to me to what it used to. When people say media reports, it means something different to me. It's almost like the language of freedom and brainwashing tyranny are very, very similar, but the people who are brainwashed into loving tyranny cannot understand the language of freedom, but the people who understand the language of freedom interpret the language of tyranny perfectly.
Yes, that I like that explanation, Benny. It's so true. I've forgotten the author, but years ago there was some Leninist author. He was right. It was written in a textbook of how to lead the masses. They use the softer phrase, I think they say, how to influence the masses or educate the masses, but they were talking about how to manipulate the masses, and they made no bones about it. And they said, quite frankly, that the purpose of revolutionary language was not to communicate, but to obfuscate. And boy, that stuck in my mind. Boy, he said it exactly right. That's the purpose of propaganda, is not to communicate, but to obfuscate.
And this also brings us to another interesting element of what happens into the, as you so eloquently put it, the quote-unquote movement, is that now the people within the movement who are still getting over their brainwashing are interpreting things like you and me are saying as being part of the evil propaganda machine.
Yeah, well, that happens, yeah. Well, you know, that's a healthy sign, because at least people are asking questions now. They're questioning everybody, and I don't mind that. I think it's a sign of great wisdom to question, and at least now they're moving. They've broken away from the anchor that kept them in docile submission and acquiescence and acceptance of the status quo. Now they're in motion, and they've got to, you know, send out their feelers and say, well, wait a minute, is this a good path? No, that's no good. How about this one? They have to test all the paths, and that's, I think that's healthy. So we just have to accept it as something we have to deal with.
Well, being in motion, I was just thinking about that. Are they in emotion? Because I've likened the awakening process from believing everything the government and the media tell you to knowing that the vast majority of what they and almost every other kind of authority system in the entire frickin' world is full of BS. In order to transition from column A to column B, there's a transition period, and it seems to me that the transition period is dominated by those exact same symptoms that happen when you lose a loved one: the grief process, denial, anger, depression, negotiation, followed by acceptance.
I think that's good. Yeah, there is sort of a grieving process. I can relate to that back in the day when I had to surrender all of my mythical beliefs, my cherished beliefs. Not all of them, but too many of them. It was hard. We all want to believe in our leaders. We all want to, you know, believe in the integrity and honesty of our system. We like to believe that our courts are just and that our teachers are knowledgeable and are teaching us the truth. We want to believe those things because, you know, they give us stability. They make us feel comfortable. We don't have to worry about being lost on a dark path. And we know we're on the right path because we've been told it's the right path. So, yeah, it's hard to give up all those things, but I think your analogy is good. It is sort of like going through a period of grief. Mm. But you do come out of it. You do come out of it. So if anybody's listening, if anybody's listening that's going through that phase right now, I can assure you right now that you will come out of it, and then everything will be fine.
I'd like to, here we go. We finally found the first thing we disagree on. Sometimes they don't come. Sometimes people do not come out of it.
Oh, well, that's true. I can't even disagree with that. Sometimes,
damn it!
Okay. Yeah, sometimes they don't come out of it. But
an anecdote here, because I called up Radio Live's mainstream talk radio here in New Zealand, and a guy called Mikey Havoc on there talking about 9/11. This is on 9/11 2009, I think it was. And we had a conversation for about maybe 10 minutes on the radio about this. And he warned me, he said, there's a proviso. If you tell people this information, they might end up like my mate Jared, who killed himself. Okay? And so then I asked Mikey, okay, Mikey, you're a DJ, you're a talk radio show host, you're going out and you party, you're socially active, right? Right. Was your friend totally socially active, or was he sitting home by himself, not having anybody comfort him, listen to him, or care about him, and for all he knew, all his friends thought he was crazy? You know? Mm-hmm. That's the thing. We reject our support networks, and it's even worse when your support network rejects you. And in some cases, it is a downward spiral. I went to a dance party festival one time. I was volunteering. One of my listeners, who managed to get us in for free. And one of my other listeners, actually, who heard me on the Corbett Report randomly, you know, I love those little synchronistic meetings, came up to me and talked to me about my show, and he said that what I'm doing is damaging people, that it's dangerous for people, and then he gets up to walk away, and I said, no, it's not for them. The show is not for the newly initiated who don't know anything. This is for the people who already know that there's something going on, and they want to have a little bit of humor and a little bit of coping mechanism and a little bit of support injected into their life. That is the role that I've chosen to function in. I hope I've made the right choice. Ed Griffin, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Vinny, thank you so much for inviting me, and don't give up the ship.
Well, you know, like I said, it's not a choice, it's a lack of options.
Yeah, well, your lack of options. Well, don't forget, you said you got to offer the truth and a little bit of humor. Vinny, when does the humor start?
You know, as far as I'm concerned, it should never frickin' stop. You know, it's like the universe. There is no beginning, there is no end. Comedy is the alpha and the omega.
Keep it up, I've read. You're doing a great job.
All right. Now go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, ladies and gentlemen. Just remember, of course, that this is a listener-supported broadcast. It does not exist without you traumatized, terrible people that are having a real difficult time dealing with the scumbaggery and the scum that's accumulated at the top of your political pond that chokes out all the light and life for all of you that live beneath it. So go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Give us some of your slave money so we can continue to slave away and give you some of that welcome relief that you need. I can't distribute heroin to you in order to make you relax, but the CIA can. So you know, if you can't donate to me, donate to your government through your taxes. I'm sure they'll sort you out. Good night, everyone.